The Faces of Contemporary Islam, Fresh Perspectives on Theory, Practice, and Foreign Policy, a Women's Foreign Policy Group Conference in Washington, D.C., featuring Carnegie Scholars. This November 18, 2008 podcast is a production of the Women's Foreign Policy Group with funding from the Carnegie Corporation of New York. The following panel, Interpretations of Women's Rights and Realities for Muslim Women, features Lila Abu Lugad, a professor at Columbia University and a 2007 Carnegie Scholar, Madhavi Sundar, a professor at the University of California at Davis and a 2006 Carnegie Scholar, and Farzani Milani, a professor at the University of Virginia and a 2006 Carnegie Scholar. Patricia Ellis, the president of the Women's Foreign Policy Group, moderates.
Speak in the order that they are seated. Lila Abu Lugad, who is from Columbia University and the Carnegie Scholar, has been working on the ethics of politics of Muslim women's rights in an international field. Next to Lila is Madhavi Sundar, who is from the University of California Davis Law School, currently at the University of Chicago Law School, and her research is on the New Enlightenment, how Muslim women are bringing religion and culture out of the dark ages. And next to Madhavi is Farzani Milani, who is from the University of Virginia, and her research is on remapping the cultural geography of Iran, Islam, women, and mobility. And so, Lila, thank you.
Thank you, and thank you, Pat, for putting together this conference and everybody else who's worked so hard on it, and thank you for inviting me to be part of it. And thank you all for coming to hear. It's a long morning, coming to hear and talk with what I found out is this great group of Carnegie Scholars. Some of us know each other's work, but some of us don't, and many of us haven't even had a chance to be together in the same room, so it's wonderful. So we've already talked a lot about women, so I'm a bit embarrassed to do it again, but this panel is actually about that. So I wanted to open the panel by talking about the kinds of images of Muslim women that circulate in the U.S. and the West more generally, popular representations that are promoted by the media, although we've heard that the media is more complicated than I know it is, but also in the halls of power. And these images shape our thinking, our attitudes, and ultimately our policies towards the Muslim world. And I think they're dangerous, and I think they're dangerous for us, and I think they're dangerous for Muslim women. And as an anthropologist who spent the last 30 years on and off of my life working in the Middle East, and particularly in Egypt, and I've done field work in several different communities in Egypt, I'm puzzled by these images. Whether they're visual or literary or pseudo-scholarly.
One thinks of the forbidding white shrouds that cover inaccessible women in photos, or the women in black, often with only their eyes showing. I think you know the images I'm talking about. I didn't bring my PowerPoint. They grace the covers of New York Times Magazine, The Economist, airline magazines, you know, KLM. The National Geographic, and these images illustrate articles that are on countries as diverse as Jordan, Saudi Arabia, Yemen, or Iran, even when the articles are not about women at all. And we all know Edward Said and his book Orientalism. What he pointed out in this study of the history and politics of Western representations of the Muslim East is that these images gain their authority by citing each other, referring to each other in a kind of endless chain that need not have anything to do with realities on the ground. They must be true, we think, because they're so similar. They're so familiar. We've seen them so many times. But these images are quite limited. And they exhibit this kind of strange uniformity, and I think Susan has pointed out there are differences, and we can maybe talk about that, but I think there's a very striking uniformity. And I think that uniformity gives us, makes us think that we're looking at a single culture or a monolithic religion. They also present the Muslim woman as alien, different, distant, unconnected to us. And through these kind of forms of extreme and stylized covering, they suggest that the Muslim woman is, of course, silent or silenced, passive or oppressed. And we've already talked about the veil before, but we can talk about it again if you like. But I think the uses of these images to advertise articles on different parts of the world send us a subliminal message that these parts of the world are defined by these women's unfreedom, symbolized by the veil. And you just have to think of an analogy. What if every article in a magazine in Pakistan on the US or on Sweden or on Italy were to be illustrated by a blonde woman in a bikini? We'd laugh, you know, that's so absurd. This is stereotyping. This is generalizing about Western women and about the West. But we're not so suspicious when we see yet another Muslim woman draped in black on the cover of a magazine talking about whatever. And I think these images are dangerous because they blind us to important realities about the Muslim world. First of all, they blind the images, I think, hide from us the incredible variety of lives that Muslim women lead. We've already heard about some of those today, but there are devout women who have gone out into the public sphere to do good works and who've taken to the mosques to educate themselves about their religion, their faith. There are also young women rappers who sing in t-shirts about military occupation and police brutality, and we were talking about that last night. There are wealthy women, I'm sure you've seen them, who shop for lingerie at Harrods in London, you know, covered in black. There are also hardworking peasant women raising sheep and chickens who wear modest homemade clothes, and maybe get a pair of shoes once every 5 years. These women's lives and their aspirations and their values and their clothes, of course, differ radically, but this variety never comes to mind when we think of the Muslim woman. Now, the second thing that these images blind us to are the things that we all share. And this is very obvious, but somehow I don't think we think about it enough. The similarities across the borders. Don't Muslim women get scared when they hear the word cancer? Don't they want their children to thrive and be safe? Don't they like to dance and sing, listen to music? Don't they care about their clothes? They do. Don't they grieve when they lose loved ones? Don't they feel pride in their accomplishments? Don't they feel humiliated when they're insulted? Of course, there are differences in the exact circumstances that we all live in, and there are lots of differences between the ways we all cope with what life brings us, but I don't think these fall neatly along lines of East and West, Muslim and non-Muslim. I've been researching for my, as part of my Carnegie project, a third thing that these images blind us to, and that's the forms of connection among us all in terms of women's rights. And one connection that I could point to is, of course, the failure to have achieved gender equality or even safety for women, either here or there, if there's a here, if there's a there. It's intriguing to me how we're distracted by the kind of sensationalized differences in appearance and dress and the kinds of horror stories that we're told from thinking about the challenges that we still face here. The Women's Policy Forum is probably one of the organizations working in light of the kinds of challenges we face here. Significant wage gap, unequal representation in government and business, high rates of rape, date rape, domestic violence. Poverty in the US, you all know, is a woman's issue, with most families under the poverty line being headed by women. Our daughters have eating disorders and feel pressures to aspire to impossible body and beauty ideals. Congress never passed the ERA, the Equal Rights Amendment, and even though 90% of UN member nations have ratified CEDAW, the Convention on the elimination of all forms of discrimination against women, including most Muslim-majority nations, the U.S. has not ratified it. Now, I don't bring up these problems to excuse problems elsewhere, but just to say, let's just think for a minute about the kinds of commonalities that exist. We have cultural values, too. We have religious faith, too. We have failings in the arena of women's rights, too. But the really interesting connections that I'm studying are those that have to do with women's organized and individual struggles for rights and dignity. The images of Muslim women that we have don't even hint at the long existence of lively discussions and struggles about women's rights in all parts of the world where Muslims live. Elizabeth talked about some. It's as if only we are active, they're passive, except these few exceptional women who make it into the media that just prove that all the rest of them are silent. The Egyptian Feminist Union was formed in 1923. In 1907, a Muslim Bengali woman activist wrote in Urdu against seclusion and started girls' schools. In Iran, they started girls' schools. In the 1950s and 60s, various Arab countries had what they call state feminism, guaranteeing equal access to schooling for girls, labor rights for working women, jobs for all college graduates, irrespective of gender, paid maternity leaves, and so forth. Egypt and Iraq were among these countries. And today, in places like Egypt, there are astonishing numbers of non-governmental organizations devoted to women's issues and women's rights. Some of them share a language of rights with international organizations. Some take funding from foreign sources. Others use a different language of rights, sometimes drawn from Islamic law and the Quran. And these organizations are staffed, formed, founded, and staffed by Muslim women. This is the way the world of women's rights is now. It's international, it's interconnected, and I think Madhavi Sundar is going to be talking more about some of these organizations in a few minutes, so I won't say more about that. But what interests me even more than women activists are ordinary women and the varieties of rights that they enjoy or invoke in their everyday lives, and I'm an anthropologist, that's the kind of thing I like. So as an anthropologist, I'm asking how women in various parts of the Muslim world think about their rights. What languages do they use to talk about them? Are they the same languages of rights used by women's rights advocates in these organizations? What do any of us mean when we say women's rights? So I'll just close by telling you about a conversation I had with a village woman in Egypt last spring. And she's a woman called Nafisa, who I've known for many years through the research I did in this village in Upper Egypt. Research was on television soap operas, Egyptian television soap operas, which is where a lot of people get their ideas in the Muslim world and the Arab world, for sure. So when I told her that my new project was about women's rights in Egypt, whenever I told people this was my new project, they always had something to say. But her first reaction was, let me tell you, the woman in Egypt, this is barely educated woman in this little village, right? Let me tell you, the woman in Egypt enjoys the highest level of rights. Do you know, Lila, that we have women ministers in the cabinet, the Minister of Social Affairs, the head of the finance ministry, all of them are women. Here in Egypt, the government has given women their rights 100%. But then she went on to qualify this. She said, but people, a woman's family, they're the ones who sometimes undermine her rights. Say it happens that my father leaves me 3 acres of land when he dies. Her brother comes along and says, no, she shouldn't take it. The girl shouldn't take the land. Here the government gives her her rights. So I asked if this had happened to her, because the pronouns were all mixed up. But she just laughed and said, you know, this is just an example. You know, praise be to God, you know, I'm not complaining. My family doesn't own any land. But then she continued, so the brother takes his sister's land. It happens in some families. He says, I'm a man, I should take the land. But let's listen to what she says as her kind of retort to this imaginary brother. She said, but God, glory be to him, gives the woman an inheritance. She then quoted a Quranic passage that mandates that women inherit. And she finished up, so if God sent down in the Quran word that a woman is entitled, how dare you fight this? Unquote. When I asked what a woman does if her brother tries to take her share, she responded, she goes to the government. But then a few seconds later, she said, well, First, she goes to complain to the family, to the elders in the family. And a few minutes after that, she gave yet a third answer. She asked me if I'd met the respected religious figure in the next village, and he's a professor at Al-Azhar, the Islamic University in Cairo, whose father before him was also a local religious figure. Very respected family. She said, we go to the Sheikh al-Tayyib with any problem like this. Women do. Just then her brother walked in, older brother walked into the room, and she confirmed with him, isn't it true that a girl goes to Sheikh al-Tayyib if she has a problem with her uncle or her brothers? She brings a complaint to him, and it's standard, and he listens to her. And her brother nodded and then went on to tell me a long story about a major problem that the Sheikh had, in fact, resolved. Now, in this one conversation, Nafisa talked about rights in many different registers, right? She invoked national legal rights for women. She invoked women's rights in terms of political representation. And she talked about more local conflicts within families. And then the God-given rights granted to women in the Quran, or what we call Sharia or Islamic law. And she indicated that there were various places where women could turn when their rights were being infringed, to the courts, to the elders, in the family, to a local religious figure who would intervene. Now, where did Nafisa get all these ideas? All these different registers. She got them from national TV and radio. She got them from her everyday experience in her community. She got them from her own religious family. She got them from the larger community in which, they were very proud that they had a very major religious figure nearby. I'm done. My question is, how can we take into account these many ways that women talk and think about their rights in the Muslim world? This is just one little village, one country, and so forth. But I think you can find these kinds of things everywhere, and we need to ask, how can we take seriously the many situations besides like this that I've run across in my research in which women did things or refused things not by using a language of rights, but by using a language of self-respect or dignity? Here's yet another register in which we might talk about rights for women in a Muslim community. And the question is, aren't these important? Aren't these interesting? Why aren't they part of our image of Muslim women? Thanks. I have more to say, but.
And during the Q&A, hopefully we'll get to it. So sorry.
I also know that I speak for all of us in this room to say that this has been an incredible morning, and I just want to first thank Pat Ellis and the Women's Foreign Policy Group for having the vision to bring us all together. I've been a Carnegie Scholar now for a couple of years, but this is my first time also, like Layla mentioned, to have this opportunity to actually see the other scholars face-to-face, and these face-to-face meetings are still incredibly important, despite the fact that we read one another's work, but to actually have this opportunity to engage. So I thank Carnegie and all of you who've made this possible. Now, I come to you from the perspective of a legal scholar, and my specific interest is then in how law understands, or more often, unfortunately, misunderstands religion and culture. And going further, I'm asking, what are the specific consequences for women's rights in particular from law's misconception of religion? And so I want to begin then with an assertion, and that is that today human rights law has a problem with religion. In the 21st century, abuses that are no longer tolerated when committed by states are paradoxically, however, tolerated in the name of the human rights called the freedom of religion or the right to culture. The Convention on the Elimination Against Discrimination, all forms of discrimination against women, is an important case in point here. Known as the International Bill of Rights for Women, the convention has the dubious distinction of being one of the most ratified international conventions to date, but it is also one with the most reservations to it by states claiming exception based on cultural and religious grounds. And they object to, in fact, core provisions of the CEDAW agreement. But I submit, contrary to the conventional literature in this area, that religion qua religion is not our problem. Rather, the problem is law's conception of religion. law has inherited an Enlightenment view that heralded freedom and democracy and reason in the public sphere, but left the private spheres of culture and religion in, as we already heard, the dark ages of imposition and unreason. Law today has a static, homogeneous view of religion as an extra legal sphere without rights. It is a space where inequality is not only accepted, but it's to be expected. And I've argued in my work that this view of religion has the unfortunate consequence of often seeing legal authorities deferring to traditional leaders within religious communities who present this and confirm this monolithic view of religion, and that this deference often has the inadvertent effect of suppressing the actual plural claims on the ground for democracy and equality within real live religious communities today. In short, religion often gets the bad rap, but really law is often the problem. But on the ground today, women reformers in the Muslim world are in fact leading the effort, I submit, to critically confront both the fundamentalist view of depiction of religion as static and monolithic and incontestable, but also law's view of religion as incontestable and imposed from the top down. So to that extent, let me introduce you to one such reformer, Zaina Anwar. Anwar grew up in a Malaysia tolerant of many religions and of women's freedom and equality. She'd studied journalism both in Malaysia and later abroad. But by the time she returned to Kuala Lumpur in the late 1980s, the pluralist, modern, and tolerant country of her youth had changed. Through her journalism, she saw the havoc that a newly introduced, quote, Islamic family law was wreaking on women's lives in particular. The main problem was that because these laws were justified in the name of religion, they appeared immune from critique. Traditional legal challenges were to no avail, and critics were labeled blasphemous, daring to go against divine law. Women's rights activists appeared paralyzed. As time went on, however, these activists began to realize, quote, we cannot just deal with the law, unquote, Anwar recounts. Quote, we felt we really needed to study the religion, she said. Does the religion really say that a man or a woman is equal to half of a man and all that stuff we were hearing? So we decided, she says, to read the Quran for ourselves, unquote. The year was 1989. These were women of letters, lawyers, journalists, academics, and they began meeting weekly in Anwar's home, just as the philosophes had met in salons. Anwar and her colleagues began reading the Quran. Their discussions were led by Dr. Amina Wadood, an African-American Muslim scholar who fortuitously had landed her first teaching job at the International Islamic University in Kuala Lumpur. Wadood had just completed her dissertation at that time titled Quran and Women, and her aim was to teach these women the prerequisite skills for reading the Quran on their own and offering their own interpretations of the text with enough authority to question and stand beside counter-interpretations. Wadood called this group Sisters in Islam. And in 1991, the sisters first went public. On the ground, women were pushing for a domestic violence law, but legislators were arguing that the law would not apply to Muslims. The sisters published a polemical in retort, provocatively titled, Are Muslim Men Allowed to Beat Their Wives? Over the next decade, these modern-day Thomas Paines, as I call them, published pamphlet after pamphlet and penned tens of letters to the editor, provoking robust public debate over contentious religious questions, from the prophet's views on polygamy to family planning. Piercing the veil of religious sovereignty that typically shields religious authorities from critique, Sisters in Islam used common sense and reasoned argument to question religious authorities' claims, expose dissent and plurality within the religion, and force reasoned dialogue that would require justifying laws beyond the talismanic claim that they were simply Islamic. The Enlightenment took us from a world of empire to an age of reason and equality in the public sphere. But it left the private spheres of culture and religion in the dark ages of imposition and unreason. But today, on the front lines of women's movements in the Muslim world, we're hearing the rumblings of what I call a new Enlightenment. No longer content to accept freedom in the public sphere and tyranny in the private, increasingly individuals are seeking to bring democracy, reason, and the call in Kant's words to think for oneself, to the private spheres of religion and culture. The New Enlightenment seeks to bring light to these dark spaces. And a core aspect of this movement is that it rejects the traditional human rights framework that would force women to choose between religion and rights. In the modern world, as we heard from the Gallup World Polls, individuals want both. Muslim women are themselves at the forefront then of forging strategies, though, to take two women on the ground at the grassroots level for operationalizing how we can now begin to reconcile, in fact, democracy and equality in the cultural spheres of religion and culture. Now, what Mark Layla has called the great separation between religion and the state was also, as we can begin to see, a great compromise. Today, the core Enlightenment values of democracy, critical thinking, and equality are recognized only in the public sphere. But women reformers in the Muslim world are engaged in just what might be the next great separation. They are separating that part from religion, which is ineffable and divine, and that part which is, in fact, the result of human interpretation and construction and is thus eligible for reconstruction. we heard earlier the concern that Muslim women dissidents aren't, in fact, engaging the work of Muslim scholars enough. But the women reformers who I am studying are, in fact, engaging with the work of theological and academic progressive Islamic scholars who distinguish, importantly, between Sharia, which reflects divine law and timeless principles, and the actual interpretation and actualization of Sharia in real societies in the form of legal rules or fiqh. These legal rules or fiqh, they argue, are the result of human interpretation and as such are historically determined, fallible, and most importantly, subject to change. There are really two prongs to the strategies of the women's movements that I'm studying. The first is, of course, to recognize the plurality of actual options and to contest this monolithic depiction of Islam. But going further, women are also engaged in grassroots efforts to facilitate dialogue throughout the Muslim world among women at the grassroots level to engage religious texts just like Sisters in Islam had begun to read the Quran for themselves. We see through, I've been following the work of a particular manual written by Mana Zafkami called Claiming Our Rights, which has been adapted in more than a dozen countries to facilitate grassroots workshops. I've covered some of the workshops in Jordan in particular. These workshops have been taking place for more than a decade now, where women are encouraged to read texts, religious texts for themselves, but to also then critique and question and debate these texts and offer their own interpretations. We heard earlier today about calls for operationalizing democracy and freedom within an Islamic framework, and I would suggest to you that this is in fact what's already being done on the ground. But at the same time, the strategy of exposing the plurality of options also changes our conception of what an Islamic or religious approach to rights is, because inevitably these women are engaged in reasoned dialogue and are using arguments from religious sources as well as other sources. Let me give you an example, the final example before I conclude, and that is legal reform movement, which has actually been quite successful using these strategies in the case of Morocco. Borrowing arguments on polygamy and guardianship offered by Sisters in Islam in Malaysia, in the early 1990s, Moroccan activists embarked on a, quote, 1 million signatures campaign to show widespread dissatisfaction with the country's family law there, which said that women should obey their husbands, gave men unilateral rights to divorce, and deprived divorced women of custody of their children. That movement, too, began with the premise that Islamic family law is not sacred or doomed to remain unchanged. And these women basically also engaged in reasoned argument to contest 100 measures of the old family code. And they offered reasoned arguments at four different levels. So these arguments included religious doctrinal arguments, but also they offered arguments from national law, from international law, and they presented changing sociological facts based on women's actual lived experiences today. The Moroccan campaigners emerged victorious in 2004 with a new Muslim family law code that recognizes women and men as equals, allows women who remarry to retain custody of children, and makes polygamy nearly impossible. The new Moroccan family law has in fact been hailed as one of the most progressive in the Muslim world and now is seen as a model law for other countries to emulate. Just like the old Enlightenment, the new Enlightenment is a transcontinental, transnational movement. Today, Nigerian lawyers turn to members of the Pakistani bar for progressive legal arguments to use in Sharia courts. And in fact, sharing this information has helped to prevent even a single stoning for adultery from being carried out in the country of Nigeria. Reformers in Mauritania and Malaysia study the strategies of the Moroccan campaigns to reform its family law. And now in Iran, reformers have started their own 1 million signatures campaign, and the Moroccan family law reformers have published their handbook in Persian to assist their Iranian counterparts. This viral, transnational nature of these reform efforts suggests that reading the Quran in Kuala Lumpur may ultimately prove far more radical than reading Lolita in Tehran. No, but I just want to say two last things. That one is that these efforts are not, it would be a mistake to cast them as merely strategic and employing religious discourse because this is the best avenue for change today. The reformers of what I call the New Enlightenment are offering an important challenge to the Enlightenment vision of freedom itself, which envisioned freedom in the public sphere as freedom. These women are suggesting that we need a richer theory of freedom that would also secure democracy and equality within those spheres of life which are most dear to us, specifically religion, culture, and within the home. And to conclude, I just want to say a couple things about how that now, as we prepare to transition to an Obama administration, I want to suggest that we as Americans have a role to play as outsiders vis-a-vis these internal reform movements. On November 4th, President-elect Obama spoke, quote, to those who seek peace and security everywhere, declaring, quote, we support you. I suggest that, in fact, merely recognizing these reform movements and showing solidarity with them can empower them. As I've already suggested, deference, in contrast to religious elites, buttresses their power and obscures and suppresses internal dissent. Similarly, rhetoric of saving Muslim women and justifying wars for this cause also strengthens anti-Western hardliners, as Professor Thompson's own history retold earlier today, and as we see in Iran as well today. Women's reform movements most certainly become all the more difficult in such political contexts. So in contrast, then, the right kind of support can go a long way. As leading reformers in the Muslim world, from the Nobel laureate Shirin Ebadi to Iranian dissident journalist Akbar Ghanji have emphasized, Western recognition and support of their efforts promotes peace. It's harder to justify war on a nation when we recognize that their majorities, in fact, share our values. But going further, cross-cultural dialogue also lends most needed and cherished affirmation to internal reformers and provides an important source of new ideas to reformers on the ground. We witnessed historic change in America this month, and let us not doubt that Muslim reformers abroad will not similarly be able to achieve their own grassroots change as well. Thank you.
Good afternoon. It's an honor to share the podium with such eminent scholars and to be in the presence of such a distinguished audience. I'm also very grateful to Carnegie Corporation of New York, in particular to Patricia Rosenfeld and Hilary Wiesner, and to Women's Foreign Policy Group, and in particular, Patricia Elias, for giving me the chance to share with you some thoughts on how women in Iran are remapping the cultural geography of their country and reorganizing its political and visual landscape. My Carnegie project revolves around the freedom of movement and its impact on the lives of Iranian women. My thesis is very simple. A woman not only needs a room of her own, as Virginia Woolf remarked in her delightful seminal work, A Room of One's Own, but also the freedom to leave it and return to it at will. Because a room without that very right is a prison cell. The unconditional, untainted, and unrestricted right of entry and exit is a basic individual right. It epitomizes in its embodied form the capacity for exercising and enjoying an elemental sense of freedom, self-propelled, self-willed, self-choreographed. Denial of free movement in the form of incarceration, institutionalization, sex and race segregation, like forced movement, and there are many examples of that, deprives human beings of the integrity, boundaries, and control of their bodies. It denies them autonomy and authority. Small wonder, then, if Article 13 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights proclaim that everyone has the right to freedom of movement. With the advent of modernity, with the increasing access to motorized mobility, freedom of movement has become even more important, more valued. In fact, so much so that its denial has become the modern instrument of punishment. Consider the multiplication and expansion of prisons as a modern form of punishment. A punishment that has shifted its locus from death and torture to mechanisms of coercive immobilization. Incarceration, which occupies such a central place in modern penal systems, deprives the prisoner of a wide range of personal rights. But I believe at the basis of all these deprivations is indeed the lack of freedom of movement. The privilege to enjoy self-directed movement, the power to pick up and go as one pleases, without incurring any penalties, has not been a right granted all. Often, it has been recognized as a masculine prerogative. Often, it has been denied to women. Women have found themselves locked in or locked out. The first ones in the door or the first ones out of it. Sanctioned in the name of religion, chastity, safety, beauty, or autonomy, and anatomy, women's restricted mobility has been assumed or prescribed. A woman on the loose, in many cultures, is viewed as a woman of loose morality. Consider for a moment the enigmatic figure of the female witch, condemned for her disregard of prescribed boundaries. To this day, she is popularly portrayed flying on her broomstick, the very symbol of her restrained mobility and domesticity, turned into a magical vehicle able to carry her to forbidden places. Now, Iran. For centuries, we Iranian women have been denied freedom of movement, especially in open and public places. For the last 160 years, and might be of interest to you to know that exactly at the same time as this fantastic congregation at Seneca Falls happened in July of 1848, we had something similar to that happening in Iran. So for the last 160 years, especially during the last two decades, women have renegotiated boundaries and emerged as a most moderating, modernizing force in my country of birth. Let me give you some specific examples. Women's life expectancy has increased from 64.7 in 1990 to 71.9 today. Although the Islamic Republic proceeded quickly to lower the age of marriage for girls to 9, the median age of marriage today for women is 24. Fertility rate has dramatically decreased from 5.6 in 1990 to 2.3 today. Attendance at elementary school is at 94%. And gender disparities do not increase in institutions of higher education. As a matter of fact, 64% of all students admitted to Iranian universities are women. In fact, some of the members of Iranian parliament are considering affirmative action for men. Let me give you some examples about the literary scene, the one area I'm most interested in. Let's consider fiction for a moment. From the 1930s into the 1960s, only about a dozen women published works of fiction in Iran. I'm done?
No.
The number of women who have published novels has now reached 370, which is 13 times as many as 10 years ago and equal to the number of men novelists. Often women outsell their male counterparts, and I'm proud to say, as a judge occasionally on these literary awards, women are truly some of our best novelists, too. The same phenomenal growth of women producers of prose can be witnessed in the number of women translators. Whereas in 1997, Iran had only 214 women translators, the number soared to 706 6 years later in 2003. The same is true of women working in the publishing industry, which for now, just to cut it short because I see 3 minutes, we have 103 women publishers in Iran. As for poetry, for the first time in Iran's glorious literary tradition, we have one woman as our national poet. The elegance and beauty, the candor and courage of Simine Behbahani. And I'm embarrassed to say that most of these women have not even been translated into English, has bestowed upon her the status of a cultural hero. And Furugh Farrokhzad, who was banned soon after the revolution, has become now the Iranian equivalent of a rock star, a guru, a cultural icon. With 23 million internet users and an amazing 7,100% rate of growth between 2000 and 2007, Iran has the fastest growing number of internet users in the whole Middle East. And women here too play a most important and active role. And as my colleague referred to, something unheard of in Iranian history has begun, a far-reaching campaign undertaken by Iranian women, the campaign for 1 million signature. It was launched on August 27, 2006, and it is really doing some amazing work inside the country. Now, please allow me to hasten to add that I do not entertain any illusions about the Islamic Republic of Iran. Repression, political and religious purges, censorship and gender inequity are facts of life. Women lack equitable political representation, but they do everywhere. The pantheon of the highest government offices in the land is monopolized by men. The supreme leadership, the presidency, membership in the Guardian Council, the National Security Council, and the Expediency Council do not include even a token woman. Although an increasing number of women nominate themselves for presidency, they have so far all been disqualified. I have a number of other statistics, but I have to conclude. So what am I saying? All I'm saying is that it is this complex mixture of advancements and drawbacks, of protest and accommodation, of resistance and acquiescence, of tradition and modernity that reflects most accurately a woman's life in Iran today. Focusing on either side of this equation is a willful misrepresentation of facts with dangerous consequences. Iran is a land of paradoxes. It's a society in transition. And surely, no one can accuse the Islamic Republic of Iran of intolerance towards its own contradictions, especially when it comes to the treatment of its women. Iranian women can vote and run for some of the highest elected offices in the country, but must observe an obligatory dress code. They can drive personal cars, even taxis and trucks and fire engines, but they cannot ride bicycles. They're seated away from men in the back of buses, but they can be squashed in between perfect strangers in overcrowded jitney taxis. They have entered the world stage as Nobel laureates, human rights activists, best-selling authors, but to leave the country of their residence, they need the written permission of their legal guardian, always a man. So allow me to conclude with a question. In view of such a complex, but definitely dazzling sense of movement, in view of such refusal to be assigned a walled-in space or role, why is the dominant image of Iranian women in the U.S. that of a virtual prisoner without pardon or parole? Why are bestsellers portraying Iranian women as victims of an immobilizing fate, captives of a country made up of male guards, detainees in a veritable giant gulag the size of the whole country. Why we, as readers in the U.S., are more interested in abducted daughters, incarcerated girls, and invisible women. Thank you.
This has been a production of the Women's Foreign Policy Group with funding from the Carnegie Corporation of New York. For more information about this and other Women's Foreign Policy Group events, please visit www.wfpg.org.